this morning. Sorry, just getting a few things set up here. Okay. So my name is Adam Paul, and I'm joined this morning by Donna Norman and Bruce McWilliams of the FCIC as well. Just to start off here, we record all these interviews, and I have to just ask you on tape that you'll agree to be recorded this morning.
Sure, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. And just as a sort of by way of background, we have a little just section about who we are really quickly that we run through with everyone that we interview. So today's date is Tuesday, November 16th, 2010, at about 10 a.m. Eastern. And as I said, it's myself, Adam Paul, it's Don Norman, and Bruce McWilliams of the FCIC, who are joined this morning by Mr. James Sawicki by phone. And just for your background, the FCIC was created by law and signed into law by the president. It's a bipartisan commission and consists of 10 commissioners, and we are charged with examining the cause of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the president and Congress by December 15th, 2010, so working on a short deadline here. And coming to a close actually rather quickly. And so we like to start these interviews with a couple of basic questions. And so if you could just go ahead and give us a brief overview of your professional background, that would be helpful.
I am a business columnist for The New Yorker and also the author of a book called The Wisdom of Crowds. And I have been a business writer for... Well, I've written for The New Yorker now for about a decade, a little more than a decade, and been a business writer more generally for, I guess, about 15 years, since the mid-90s. I don't know what else is useful. I mean, I've written for a wide variety of other publications, but really that, you know, the New Yorker job is really my central job.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you very much. And we like to usually start off here with the big, broad question to sort of get a sense of what people might want to speak to. And the big, broad question would be, in your opinion, what caused the financial crisis?
I think the obvious thing to say is I don't think there was a single cause.
Sure.
But I think that it really represented the confluence of a number of really important trends. And developments over, well, you could say the last decade, but it probably goes back even further than that. I mean, if you needed one phrase to describe what happened, I would basically say, you know, that it was the result of a housing bubble. That while I think that there are a host of institutional and kind of structural issues that are very important and played a massive role in the particular way the financial crisis manifested itself, I think, you know, the core problem ultimately was simply that housing prices got way out of whack, and as a result, essentially left us with a debt overhang of trillions of dollars. When I think about, for instance, what the banks did, the way I sometimes think about it is that, you know, they basically made the worst bet in history. Because if you think about what a mortgage is, basically, it's essentially a bet by investors. Historically, it was a bet by banks. Now it tends to be more of a bet by investors because of securitization. That both that the borrower will pay back the money, but also that if the borrower doesn't pay back the money, that the property that they're going to get when they foreclose, the security will be worth, you know, something relatively close to what it's appraised at and to what they might be able to resell it. And the reality is that the mortgages people made were, and the refinancing banks made, were really nowhere near close to what the actual value was. It was much, much higher. So I think that's the core problem. Now, I think what magnified that, and I think one of the reasons why that bubble got going was, you know, these other issues that everyone now, I guess, is pretty familiar with. I do think the role that securitization plays is very important. I'm not someone who thinks securitization is, you know, something we should do away with, but I do think that the further away sort of lenders got from borrowers, in the sense that the ultimate lender in a securitization model is really the investor, who has no real contact with the actual loan and no real contact with the actual borrower. That the further the lender and borrower were separated, the more likely it became that you would get a lot of you would get a lot of reckless loans. I think that, sorry about that, my phone periodically just sticks out like that. I think that the kind of relentless, and again, this is a sadly obvious point, the sort of relentless focus, short-term focus of Wall Street firms, just in terms of the way compensation structures worked, lent itself to a kind of willingness to just go along with the ride for the ride. You know, the phrase there that always comes to mind is the kind of acronym IBG, YBG, you know, I'll be gone, you'll be gone, basically by the time the loan comes due. And I think that had a major effect as well. And I think there's also a broader kind of social and systemic problem, which is the kind of obsession, call it an obsession, I don't know why my phone keeps doing that, I would basically call it an obsession, in the United States with home ownership. And I think that's both a kind of cultural thing, I think it's also a political thing. I think the tremendous emphasis placed by politicians on increasing the rate of home ownership also created, I think helped foster the idea that buying a home was always the right thing to do. And so going to great lengths to buy a home if you were an ordinary American, or alternatively going to great lengths to make home loans available, I think also had some kind of impact in terms of basically just pushing lots of people into home ownership who either shouldn't have been there or should have been there under very different financial circumstances. So I guess, you know, those would be the things that immediately come to mind when you ask, you know, what are the causes?
Okay, great. So I guess I have a couple of quick follow-up questions from the what you just ran through. And I'd like to start where you started, that is with the housing bubble. And we've gotten, in the course of our investigations, a lot of differing opinions on when this bubble sort of started. And so I guess my first question would be, when did you start to see prices become out of whack, or when did people start to express that opinion to you?
Well, I mean, I know people... there's some people who argue that it goes back to the late 1990s, that's actually when you can really start to see kind of the divergence in home prices from their historical trends. And I can sort of understand. I mean, when I think about bubbles, I really think about, the way I sort of think about it is a profound divergence from what you might call fundamental value. In the case of homes, I think that is one way of thinking about that is sort of rents. You know, if you think about a home as kind of a stream of rent that you either pay to somebody else or alternatively that you keep for yourself by living in the home. So you have a divergence from fundamental value, but also I think another element of a bubble is that I think is really important is the kind of speculative dimension, which is to say that people begin, one of the things that becomes important in people's decisions is the ability to, or the thought that they will be able to resell this property at a higher, well, a much higher price somewhere down the road. You know, it's kind of, and I think, you know, if you go back to the late 1990s in the stock market, that's really, I think, what was driving a lot of the price appreciation in the stock market. Housing is probably slightly different. I think that speculative dimension began to play a very important role in, you know, 05, 06. But to me, I really think, you know, when I first really started to think about it, it was probably 02, 03. And that was really when you started to see the first signs of it. It was, you know, there were some interesting things, like the fact that the housing market in San Francisco held up as well as it did after the bursting of the stock bubble. That was very surprising to me, and I think suggested that there was something unusual about what was happening in housing. And I think, at least in New York, you had a sort of similar phenomenon. You again you know, had a housing market that continued to rise, even though you would have thought, again, the kind of bursting of the stock bubble, the, you know, crackdown on Wall Street would all have had an impact, and it didn't. And, you know, and I sort of can just on a personal level can sort of remember thinking, you know, in 03, 04, the sort of thinking to myself, like, should I buy something or whatever? And at that point, it already seemed much too expensive, you know, just in terms of what you could get relative to what you could get from renting. And so that's kind of when I started sort of thinking it started to get going. But, you know, obviously the real acceleration of it happened in you know, 05, 06 were the killer years, I think.
Sure. And since you had mentioned the stock bubble and how well housing and a few other sectors in the general economy held up in that, we've heard about that issue before. As someone who covered it, do you think that we learned the wrong lessons from the stock bubble as far as housing?
You mean in the sense of kind of money would just move somewhere else, or we shouldn't let the bubble burst, basically? Or
yeah, I mean, this idea that we've heard from a couple of different people that the bursting of the stock bubble and the fact that it didn't damage, you know, the overall economy in large ways in other places, that people became even more confident that they could handle risk and bubbles.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting idea because, I mean, I do think that there was a, you know, one thing to keep in mind when you think about that question, when we think about that question, is obviously, you know, there is a kind of way in which we retrospectively make things seem, probably cast a more rosy glow, probably via the use of statistics. Because certainly, you know, if you go back to 2000, if you remember what it was like, or 2001, it certainly felt pretty bad, I think, you know. And you know, the recession, you know, I think people were already feeling it in 2000, and it probably had, I think it probably had some effect, for instance, on the election in one way or another. I mean, the recession may not have officially started. I can't remember exactly when it started. But I do think that the fact that we got out of it reasonably quickly, although obviously, again, very, very, you know, the growth was pretty weak in the wake of it, probably did have some effect in terms of thinking. You know, I think it contributed to this notion of the great moderation, that basically we had attained this new kind of plateau where even though you could have these sort of really, the stock market bubble, the rise and fall was pretty sharp, you know, even though you could have these things, that the basic fundamentals of the economy were, we had a pretty good handle on them and the like. And so, yeah, I think it had some dimension to it. I mean, the other thing I kind of think about when I think about that whole period is that, you know, one of the really interesting questions that I don't think we have an answer to, and I don't think we will have an answer to, is if we had not had a housing bubble, what would have picked up the slack from the, you know, internet bubble bursting, basically? Because the internet bubble, aside from its impact on the stock market, let's just say not the internet bubble, let's say the technology bubble more generally, aside from its impact on the stock market, you know, had a massive effect on the real economy. You had huge amounts of money going into investment. You had, you know, job creation was obviously off the charts, I mean, relative to the post-73 period. You had all of these things going on, and, you know, a lot of that went away when the bubble burst. And it's a really interesting question to think, like, well, what if we hadn't had a housing bubble? What if we had just, I don't know, you know, tried to have a real regular economy? And it's not clear to me. I don't really know what would have picked up the slack. So I think in that sense, you know, the housing bubble, sometimes when I think about it as kind of papering over some problems that we maybe didn't really have solutions for at the time.
Okay. And you also mentioned in your larger response about the crash itself, that politicians and both a cultural phenomenon push people into buying homes who maybe shouldn't have been buying. Could we talk about those borrowers and buyers for a second? Did they just not understand the products that they were buying, or were there really some big, you know, push forces where there were loans that were made that were fraudulent? What was what was convincing people they could afford these loans?
Well, I think there are a variety of things going on. I mean, first of all, the system is set up to encourage people to buy homes. So, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, although they obviously kept denying they had this, federal guarantee behind them, everyone assumed what in fact turned out to be true, which was that the federal government would never allow them to fail. And so their presence in the market, there are interesting academic studies that try to measure how much the presence of Fannie and Freddie lower interest rates and make it easier for people to buy loans. But the reality is that they had, I think, a major impact on the fact that, if you had what does conforming mortgage mean? It means a mortgage that they will buy, right? I mean, that's what the definition of conforming is. And so that, in that way, they kind of shape the market, even if, as we know, they were not the primary engine of, for instance, subprime lending. But so that's an impact. The mortgage interest tax deduction, obviously, again, that's the federal government basically saying, if you buy a home, we're going to give you, a break. Like, if you're a renter, you don't get that. I mean, the federal government is essentially subsidizing home ownership. So there are these, and then obviously, administrations. The Clinton administration did it. The Bush administration did it. Trumpet the rate of home ownership as, a triumph, right? The higher the rate of home ownership, the better things are. And this is, and I think that there are these deeper historical cultural roots about the notion of home ownership. I mean, if you compare us to, Germany, what the rate is in Germany. It's like 40%, maybe less than that, of home ownership. And no one thinks of that as evidence that the German economy is, weak or anything like that. It's just home ownership is not seen as a sine qua non for economic strength, but in the U.S. it is. So I think there are all these bigger things, right? And then I think on top of it, you have obviously this kind of flood of money. You had a kind of fantasy, I guess you'd have to call it a fantasy, on the part of investors that securitization had essentially distributed risk in such a way that they no longer need to worry about, the fact that people might not be able to pay back their loans. And then I think on the part of borrowers, I think it's a complicated thing on the part of borrowers. I think that it's very clear if you look at, books like just a couple books, recent books, Gary Rivlin's book, USA, or this new book by Michael Hudson called Monster about subprime lenders like AmeriQuest. It's very clear that in some cases, in many cases, let's say perhaps, I don't know how many, but let's say in a good number of cases, people didn't really understand what they were doing. They didn't understand how interest rates would reset. They were arguably misled by things like adjustable rate mortgages and the like. In other cases, there was just explicit fraud and the like. So there was some of that. But I think that, I also think on the part of borrowers, there was a sense that buying a home was really always going to be a financially smart thing to do. That it was the best way to build wealth for the future. There's this kind of unfortunate intersection there between, I think, what borrowers were thinking and what people who were trying to increase the rate of home ownership among low-income houses were doing, because, actually borrowing in order to be able to buy a home actually can be quite useful. I mean, the Wall Street banks have made billions by leveraging themselves, so leverage can be quite useful. I think the problem was that what people didn't really, for a variety of reasons, think very hard about was how the nature of mortgages had changed and how that changed the financial calculus. And then on top of it, and more importantly, this seems incredibly obvious, and I seem stupid to even mention it, but, deciding whether or not an investment is a good investment or not depends a lot on the price at which you buy. And so, buying a house may make a lot of sense at X price, but it probably doesn't make any sense at 3X. And I think that that lesson just basically was kind of forgotten, which is the nature of a bubble. I mean, that's what happens in bubbles. People become relatively indifferent to price. And so I think a lot of borrowers just didn't even think about, the fact that it doesn't make any sense to leverage yourself up to buy a house at this price, because you're never going to be able to actually make any get any equity in it. And I think that was a big problem. Let me just say one other thing. I'm sorry for going on so long, but let me say one other thing about that, which is that I also think that one of the things that people kind of didn't really think about was the and maybe this is because it didn't really begin to explode until like 04, 05, whatever. But we also didn't really think enough about what the explosion in home equity loans would mean and refinancing. Because I don't think we really, this was really, one of the things that's distinctive about this bubble is first of all how much of it was driven by or when you look at the number of loans and the amount of money that was out, you know, how much of it was home equity or second mortgages or whatever, refinancings. And the other thing that was distinctive about it, and it's very important in this regard, obviously, is, again, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but is how much of that equity was taken out, right, by people and used for spending or college education, whatever it was. And that really changes the economics of home ownership. Because I think one of the reasons why home ownership was actually useful in the past, and it's useful to people in terms of building wealth, is simply that it works as forced savings, right? I mean, we know from behavioral studies, people have a hard time saving generally. And a home is a kind of, it's a way of forced saving, right? You pay your mortgage every month, and, you know, you're probably better at doing that than you would be just putting it in the bank every month and blah, blah, blah. So you're, but if you start taking equity out of the home on a regular basis, or you know, obviously if you take a huge chunk, which essentially, then you know the effect of forced saving, the benefits of forced savings are gone because the equity's gone. You don't have it, you know, when you retire or whatever it is. And you know, I understand why people did it. They did it because they thought housing prices were just going to keep going up. So I can take out $50,000 now, but what difference does it make? Because it'll be, you know, $100,000 3 years from now. But when that happens, when you put all those things together, and you know that's really the kind of making of a complete, well, what we got, which was a complete disaster.
I want to ask, I mean, just thinking about this story where it seems like everyone is making an investment decision, which at the time seems at the individual level like something that's going to work out well for them, but create this systemic risk. As someone who's written about crowds, how was it that everyone just got it so wrong, or was it that people were making choices that were right for them and just ignoring the systemic risk?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, you know, my colleague John Cassidy sort of talks about that his blog for us, for The New Yorker, is named, I can't remember what it is, but basically the idea is this kind of individually rational, collectively irrational thing. I think that crowds are periodically subject to these kinds of things, right? We know bubbles are a reality of markets. We know kind of irrational behavior is obviously a reality of collective human endeavor as well. My take on this is a little different. I mean, I do think that there was an element of, you know, people individually pursuing their own self-interest and that leading to collectively disastrous results. I mean, everyone was trying to pursue their self-interest. I actually am not as convinced that everyone was making individually rational decisions, actually. And I actually think in a bubble, especially toward the end of a bubble, that people stop making if you look at them even on an individual level, they're not really rational because most people aren't going to be able to get out in time and the like. So I do think that, you know, part of what happens is just when you have lots of people who are swept away by an idea and basically all thinking in one direction, it's very easy for that to lead to disastrous results. I mean, one of the things I talk about in The Wisdom of Crowds is I think the defining condition of characteristic of a wise crowd or healthy market or whatever is diversity of opinion and kind of thought and information. And I think that for the most part in the market there was very little of that. You know, there really was this kind of conviction that was really being drummed home in myriad different ways, that buying a home was really the best thing to do. I actually also think, and this is only, you know, if we actually had to, if you're trying to quantify the impact of it on what happened, I think this is probably a small factor, but I actually think it's, at least from an intellectual point of view, an important one. One of the things that's different about the housing market from, like, say, the stock market, although obviously stock markets have bubbles too, but one of the things that was very, very different is, was the fact that you can't bet against the housing market. In other words, you can't, if you thought the housing market was overvalued in 2003 or 2004, there really wasn't any way to register your opinion in a kind of, you know, economic way. Since then we've had kind of, you know, we have the Shiller market, the futures market, and obviously we know there were a few short sellers who figured out a way to do it in 06 and 07. But if you thought there was a housing bubble, you know, if you were an investor or whatever, an individual homeowner or whatever it is, you could sell your house, I guess, if you were a homeowner. Dean Baker did that, The Economist, you know, sold to the top and did very well. But you couldn't do any more than that. You couldn't really bet against it, which, you know, a lot of people think that's a bad thing. I think that would have been a much better thing. Like, if we could have had ways that people who thought there was a bubble could have weighed in, you know, it might have at least kind of just made people check for an instance. Now, you know, check their thought, for instance, say, what's happening here? So essentially the market prices are all set by people who just think that the housing market is just going to keep going up. And so you kind of end up with what we ended up with, basically.
Sure. So is it possible then, just from listening to that, I mean, were we simply not inventive enough when it came to financial products? Should there have been, you know, more kinds of securities out there that might have countered some of the one-directional things that we saw from, say, RMBS products or the like?
You know, after the kind of disaster of the last decade, I hesitate to try to make a case for financial innovation, but I think I am kind of on this question, you know, on the side of somebody like Robert Shiller, who basically, you know, is keeps arguing that we need more financial innovation, not less. And I do think that had we had tools that made it easier for people who had really contrary opinions to essentially have those opinions, registered in some way, and actually allowed them to, you know, it's been possible to make bets, put their money on the line doing that, that the effects might have been different. I don't want to say that I don't think in any sense that it would have quashed the bubble. There are a host of, when we talk about doing what I'm talking about, there are a host of kind of psychological and structural issues that come into play. So, you know, Shiller did create, you know, there is this housing futures market for cities. One of the problems is it's very small. People don't seem to actually really be, you know, are not really participating in any huge numbers. We know even in the stock market, at least historically, the vast majority of people, of investors, professional investors even, don't short. There seems to be a kind of hesitation doing that. In the internet bubble, there was this practical issue, for instance, it was very hard for you to actually borrow the stock to short it. So, you know, you couldn't even really do it if you wanted to. So I don't want to, like, you know, see this as a panacea. I don't think it's a panacea. But, just from an empirical point of view, it's very interesting. If you think about the bursting of the bubble, I do think one of the moments that you can look at and think of, like, this was one of the things that started the bursting, was when the ABX index was created, basically, right? Because when you did that, you suddenly had this kind of, and it was a very crude tool, and there were all these problems with it, but, you know, it was a way of saying, well, what do people actually think is going to happen with these securities? And once you saw that, and once you saw people actually betting against it, then it actually woke people up to some degree. Now, you know, again, there are all these, once you do that, you create all these other issues that I don't want to downplay, like manipulation. That's not even manipulation, but you create all these issues. Those markets themselves are subject to bubbles and the like. But I do think that the more diversity, the better. And there was just no diversity in this market, basically.
Sure. I know Don and Bruce might have some questions, but I wanted to push just one step farther on this point. This actually kind of reminds me of something you'd written a few years back on hedge funds and their ability to actually sort of decrease volatility in markets. But it seems like doing some of this function of providing different views. And this was something we heard a lot about from people sort of in the throes of the crisis, I guess. That a lot of firms were saying that there were people out there who were, you know, shorting them sort of at Bear or at Lehman or some of those places. And actually, you know, added quite a lot of volatility in a very quick direction. What do you think brought down, or I mean, I guess the question then is, was there sort of just pent up demand then for the shorting, that if we'd had a longer run of these kind of options, that wouldn't have been so severe?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I guess I would try to, when I think about it, I try to draw a kind of distinction between the problem in markets and the problem with the kind of shorting of, say, the financial firms that the financial firms were complaining about, is that markets work best when, at least in my mind, markets work best when the market price does not have a profound and material impact on the outcome that the price is trying to measure. Does that make sense? So, you know, you know, this is why I'm sort of interested in prediction markets. So, you know, or let's just take sports gambling, which everyone sort of hates. At this point, gambling is a dirty word, but I think gambling is very useful, and I think the sports gambling is very interesting because there's a situation where, you know, except in cases where you have, like, whatever, point shaving, the bet in the market doesn't really affect the outcome on the field, right? And it's kind of independent. Horse racing is the same way. The horses don't know what odds that they're going off at. What we know about sports markets, betting markets, is that for the most part they're very efficient. They're very accurate in terms of their forecast of actual outcomes. They incorporate information very quickly, and they're very hard to beat. So you can make money sports betting, but it's very hard. Tiny percentage of people do it, and that's true at the racetrack. It's also true in Vegas, in the Vegas casino. But again, there's a kind of independence there. The event is separate from the actual. Is separate from the actual bet, in a sense, or from the price that's sort of forecasting what the event will happen. And in the case of the housing bubble, if you think about, there are people who disagree with me, but I would say that in the case of, say, John Paulson, I don't know anything about John Paulson specifically, but in, you know, I know what I've read, Zuckerman's book and all that. But if you think about the bets that Paulson was making about what was going to happen to those loans in the underlying trust or whatever, for the most part, and it's a little more complex, and we can get into it if you're really interested, but for the most part, those things were independent. So the fact that Paulson was betting against those homes, you know, may have had some impact in terms of when the bubble on Wall Street burst, but ultimately those loans were either going to get paid or not, repaid or not, independent of what he thought was going to happen. And he was either right or wrong. And so, you know, that would have been useful information, because then people would have been hesitant, maybe, to make more loans, right? Because they would have said, well, wait a second, we've got all this money betting against subprime. Do we want to keep making subprime loans? You know, whatever. I mean, you would have thought Merrill Lynch would have realized this in 2006, but didn't. But so that's another case. In the case of the financial firms like Lehman and Bear, and, you know, their sense that short sellers help demolish them or talk down their stock prices, or actually literally drive down their stock prices, there definitely is with financial firms the possibility, you know, and it's hard to model it theoretically or to figure out exactly how it happens, but you can definitely see a situation in which short selling, in fact, if you do the two, right, if you sell the stock short and then you're also you know, buying CDS protection so that, you know, the CDS spreads are really rising, you can see how you could in theory, create a kind of panic, which in turn would generate more selling, blah, 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 all the rest. And there, what the short seller is doing, the bet the short seller is making, is not independent of the outcome. It actually helps bring about the outcome, if you follow that logic out, if you follow the logic of what they're saying. And in that case, you could say, I can understand, you know, it's possible to argue people are exacerbating volatility, not moderating it in the way they otherwise would. That they're, in a sense, instead of placing, you know, kind of the countervailing bet, they're actually just kind of jumping on the train as it's already moving and making it go faster. So, you know, I think there is a very complicated question here in terms of the role of short selling in this particular crisis. You know, and I actually tend to think that the old rule about the uptick rule would have been good to keep, just because I think anything that gets markets to pause for a moment and anything that kind of just tries to go against the tendency of markets in crisis to just sort of essentially, you know, kind of once they tip, just keep moving in one direction. I think those are good things. But having said all that, the one thing I would say is I do think the shorting of financial firms reflected the fact that it was hard for people who wanted to bet against the housing bubble to do it in other ways, right? I mean, you could do it if you're Paulson or whatever, you came up with something. But betting against financial firms was the easiest way to do it. And once people realized what was going on, that's what they did. The second thing, in terms of like Lehman and Bear and the rest, is I just think one of the things that was very true of Wall Street firms is that they just had not come to terms with what it meant to be public companies and to be companies whose, you know, not just stock but also like their CDS prices and all that were publicly available. And the way in which that changed the nature of, you know, the confidence that people might or might not have in them. And that, you know, if you leverage yourself up 40 or whatever, 33, 40 times, you're putting yourself in a situation in which what people think about you basically determines whether or not you live. And if you do that and you're a public company, then, I don't know, you're in a situation where, you know, if people start betting against you, you're going to run the risk that you're just going to basically get a bank run. And I don't think, it's fascinating to me, I don't have a good explanation for why, but it doesn't seem to me that they ever really thought that hard about what that would mean.
Did, among the firms which did better, I mean, because by the end we're talking almost about, you know, Lazard I think is the last in 05 or so, 04 to go public, I mean, they're really all public companies. Was that something that was really important, that the firms that did better, that they really got this change in their culture and the dynamic of how they were organized?
Well, I mean, I do think that firms that had a better sense of you know, what it meant to be essentially dependent on, you know, kind of, I don't know, public capital or whatever it is. It's not even public capital. I mean, you know, the capital they're relying on, or the financing they're relying on isn't exactly public. It's not the shareholders. I mean, they're essentially, by being leveraged so much, they're essentially relying on short-term financing. But I do think that the companies that did better, I mean, there aren't really that many of them, really, if you think about it. But the ones that did, probably, it seems to me, had a better sense of the dangers of being seen to be weak. I think that the companies that didn't were companies that didn't do well were companies that thought that the way I would put it is they were companies that thought that their access to short-term financing was essentially guaranteed, that they would always be able to roll over their debt, and that the fact that their stock price was dropping precipitously wouldn't shake people's faith and the like. And I don't know, that seems to me to have been a, you know, really terrible bet to have made.
I guess just, I mean, when did, you know, just in the case of writing and being, you know, around market participants, when did people start to express sort of widespread concern to you about housing or the price of the market?
Yeah, you know, so that's an interesting question because, you know, the funny thing about about the press more generally. Well, let me say one thing about the press more generally, because I think it's sort of an interesting thing. I actually think if you go back, and not me, but if you go back and look at what the business press did, it's actually interesting how many, it's not a huge number, but there were quite a few like pretty big stories talking about the housing bubble pretty early. I mean, The Economist did it very early. Business Week was early. Sean Tully at Fortune did a big cover story, I think, in like 04, 05, basically about it. My colleague John Cassidy, now John's, you know, kind of bearish by inclination, unlike me. So he, you know, he was, I can't remember when he wrote, like 2001 or something. I mean, he was, you know, really ahead of it. In terms of the market itself, I mean, what I really remember is kind of the first time, you know, in New York, I mean, you know, I think that there were people, I mean, I was one of them who just felt like this is crazy, like prices are totally out of whack. But I think when people really started to think, you know, this has a house of cards dimension, like flight. At first they maybe thought it was a flight house of cards dimension. And you know, I think there were a few people who saw how much damage it would wreak. But I remember sort of late 06. And then, you know, the thing that, I mean, in retrospect, it's obvious. I mean, the thing that really got people going was early 07. So when New Century goes under, you know, that's really when I remember people. And that's late. I mean, that's late. I mean, I think for most of 06, people still thought the party was, you know, continuing, basically. And that started to sort of change just kind of in a very, like, when I think back on it, in a very kind of subtle way, sort of late 06. Having said that, I mean, you know, one of the things that amazes me, I was looking back at all this stuff I'd written, and, you know, I wrote this column, I think, in, like, around the time New Century went under, which was still reasonably, I mean, it was basically like the market's, you know, blowing up, but I was still reasonably optimistic about people's ability to, subprime borrowers' even ability to keep paying mortgages. But the thing that's kind of amazing to me about that is that column, and I am not ahead of the curve on this at all. I mean, I was, if anything, I think I was behind the curve. But that's kind of the point of the story is, I mean, that column was early 07, and Bear doesn't go under for another year. And, you know, that, again, is part of the story that's kind of, and Merrill is making, you know, continuing to build its warehouse in while this is happening. And, you know, that's the part of the story that's kind of, I don't know, remarkable to me and sort of frustrating, that that over all that time, these firms did not in any way, weren't able to sort of, you know, get their financial houses in order. Now, maybe the problem is, it's a little bit of what I said earlier, which is, you know, when you make a bet that big, that bad, you know, somebody was going to get, the damage was done, basically, at that point. Maybe it's just that there was no way. You know, you could shift the negative chips around a little bit, but ultimately, you know, disaster was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Then that's probably true. Maybe when I think about it, that's probably the case.
This is really, I mean, when you talk about Bear for, you know, not going under for another year, one of the things that always did surprise me was actually the seemingly long lag between the failure of the hedge funds in 2007 and then, you know, the actual failure of Bear, the holding company, in 2008. Was that another place where investors were just overconfident that, you know, even with these failures in a portion of the company, that things would still be okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think that definitely was a case where, I guess the way I think about, you know, the way people thought, and I certainly was one of them, was I think people kept thinking that, you know, it's kind of like a submarine, where I think we kept thinking, if you just seal off the compartment, you know, we can stop you can stop the leaking, basically. And I think that was really the idea was, you know, that the failure of the hedge funds, I mean, you know, when I think about, like, when did things really go wrong, that's obviously the moment. I mean, I have not that you need to know this, but it's interesting. I got married on July 21st, 2007, and I went on a honeymoon that week, and that week was really when, that was a month after, I think, you know, I can't remember if they both went under in June, but that was a month later, but that was really the week when it really started to, like, get going, where the panic really started to hit. And I don't know if it was that week or the following week when Kramer did his, you know, Jim Cramer did the famous thing on CNBC about, you know, Ben Bernanke having no idea how bad things were and out there and blah, blah, blah. But I think that the idea was, you know, you could just kind of, you know, basically seal off the compartment and then it would be okay. And then, you know, and then the next compartment. And then, you know, if it bursts through that compartment, you think, okay, we can seal off the next one. And then I think that in the case of Bear, you know, there are some interesting questions, like what if they just let the funds fail and not try to not essentially assume responsibility for them? I mean, they didn't, you know, not pay back the investors. Would that have helped? But I think that the result was that people didn't take any kind of systemic, you know, solution. I mean, you know, if you think about policymakers, one of the great mysteries in terms of the financial crisis is why between March of 08 and September of 08 did Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson not go to Congress to get authority to, you know, resolve financial institutions, you know, that would have allowed, even if we accept their argument that they didn't have the legal authority to take over Lehman or to put money into Lehman, you know, even, which, you know, who knows if that's right, but even if you accept that, they certainly could have gotten that legal authority between March and September. And they, as far as I know, they never went to Congress to get it. And it's like, what was the thought there? And I think part of it was just this idea that, you know, if the problem is big enough, we'll find a way to deal with it. You know, there will be, we won't allow disaster to happen. And instead, basically, we just let disaster happen.
If I can keep you on the Fed for a minute, interest rates throughout the decade falling precipitously. And in fact, if you look at, you know, after the dot-com bubble and 9/11, interest rates dropped pretty quickly and dramatically, which probably made it easier to take out home loans. And securitize them and pass them on and the like. Can you talk a little bit about the Fed's monetary policy and your view of how that might have gone a different way? In particular, you know, the counterargument that monetary policy had to go in that direction to stave off foreign investment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think one of my problems intellectually when I think about what Greenspan did is it's not obvious to me exactly what the alternative was. I mean, I know what the alternative was. The alternative was to if not to keep interest rates high in the wake of the bursting of the stock market bubble, then it was to raise interest rates sooner than he actually did, and in that way to kind of quash the I don't know if you want to call it emerging. I mean, it would already emerge, I guess, the emerging housing market bubble. I think I'm not by nature a kind of, I don't know what you call them now, hard money person. You know, just by way of background, I mean, I think what Bernanke is doing now is, you know, I think he's pursuing the right policy, and I think is probably less aggressive than he should be, I think, in terms of the QE stuff. So just that's sort of my intellectual bias, is that I think the Fed's mission is to, you know, to fight unemployment is really important, and I think that the Fed's natural bias is to obsess about inflation, because I think that's what bankers obsess about. And so I think that to the degree that the Fed prioritizes fighting unemployment, that's a better thing for the economy than a worse thing. So I think that, you know, I understand why Greenspan, you know, cut interest rates, especially, you know, if you think about 9/11 as well. And I also think that, you know, the reality is also there was a tremendous amount of money coming into the United States from China and you know, foreign investors later that help drive. I mean, the Fed doesn't control long-term interest rates, and long-term interest rates were not, you know, were not hugely high at any point during that period either. So, and the other thing is, if you actually look at inflation until maybe 07, you know, until the commodity bubble of 07, you didn't really have, I mean, I don't think anybody who thinks back on the decade really thinks, you know, wow, prices in the real world were soaring at all. So, you know, it's difficult, I think, if you're a Fed chairman to say, oh, inflation is under control, but we need to raise interest rates, which we know is going to hurt the real economy because this asset bubble is getting going. I think the problem is that if you don't do that, then you probably do increase the likelihood that asset bubbles occur. It does seem to be the case that cheap money, I don't think it's a universal law, and like, for instance, I don't believe that what a lot of people are saying right now, that, you know, that there are all these bubbles around the world because of Bernanke's policy. I don't think that's actually right. But it does seem to be the case that cheap money kind of lends itself to asset bubbles. And, you know, when I think back on it, in some ways I think actually while I think there's a case that the Fed should have maybe raised interest rates sooner, I also think that in some ways probably another role that the Fed could have played. I actually think there probably is a jawboning role that is to some extent kind of underrated. Now, as we know from Greenspan's irrational exuberance speech, you know, the short-term effects were very powerful, long-term effects were essentially nil when he did that in 96. But I actually think that had the Fed been more public in its concerns about the nature of the housing bubble, and, you know, had Greenspan, instead of giving, you know, the speech about the great virtues of the adjustable rate mortgage, instead, you know, been more public about his let's say, I mean, maybe he didn't feel it, but, you know, skepticism about the underlying economics of what was happening, that had that happened, that might have helped maybe temper things a bit. And I also think, obviously, had the Fed been more rigorous in its look at what, you know, financial institutions were doing, like lending standards and the like, I mean, bank supervision, that actually probably would have made would have helped as well. But, you know, I think it gets back to that question I asked earlier, and I really ask it as a question because I don't actually know the answer, which is, you know, what would have replaced the housing bubble had we not had it? And, you know, if Greenspan had kept interest rates at 3 or 4%, I mean, what, I don't know. I mean, it seems perfectly possible we would have had a pretty sharp and steep recession. You know, it's hard to, well, Volcker did it in 81, 82, but it's not an easy thing to do, I think, if you're a Fed chairman.
Oh, I'm undoubtedly, but the question is, can you put it off forever?
Right. So that's the question that I think that's the question that I don't know from a theoretical point of view. Can you? I mean, I don't know.
Once the interest rates are, you know, where you can't effectively lower them, I guess is the question. And I also wonder if the lowering of the interest rates, more so than purchase of new houses, encourage the refinancing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is right. That you know, played a huge that. Sorry, that's my call. Wait, can you hold on 1 second?
Sure.
Yeah. You know what? I'll let that go. I think that I'm going to get one more quick. I think that did play a role in the refinancing. I mean, but, you know, and that again is like gets to this question of what was actually driving the economy, in the sense that, you know, we know that, well, Greenspan himself talked about this. I mean, refinancing generated a huge amount of consumer activity. I mean, in terms of, you know, going directly into consumer spending in 05 and 06. And, I'm not a believer in the kind of hangover, generally speaking, I'm not a believer in the hangover theory of recessions. That is to say that recessions are sort of necessary penalties we pay for good times, you know, a kind of cyclical, the kind of classical sort of, I don't know, I guess it's like an Austrian idea of unemployment. I mean, I generally think recessions are the product of, you know, just basically an absence of demand, which, you know, monetary policy can play a major role in alleviating. But I do think that, you know, the question that I keep asking myself now is, you know, what takes the place? I mean, of, you know, essentially we just put it off. So that basically what we're going through now is what we would have gone through in 02, 03, 04 if, you know, if we hadn't had the housing bubble to, you know, give people jobs and build all these homes that, you know, in the end no one is going to live in. I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that.
How do you pronounce your name?
Surowiecki.
Mr. Surowiecki. As a journalist, have you come across any things, any sort of things that haven't really come out in the press yet? Things that we might, sort of tips they might want to give us, or things that would be interesting for us to investigate that, for whatever reason, you've not been able to pursue or something like that?
That's a question I wish I had a good answer to, and I don't think I do. Let me think about that for a second. That's actually a great question, and I let me just think if there's anything that I
bank executives, regulators, people said things to me that's off the record. You can't tell anybody about.
No, you know, I mean, I haven't had anything like that recently. I mean, most of the stuff that's happened is stuff. Most of the stuff I've, you know, has been stuff that I kind of have has been stuff that I've written about, and I don't have any. I wish I had some, like, great tidbit I could give you so you could go. I'm trying to think. There's nothing. Let me think. I'll see if I can come up with something, but I can't think of anything that immediately comes to mind in that regard.
Okay. Well, not trying to steal an idea, but maybe something that's, for whatever reason, you couldn't, you know, wasn't in your bailiwick or just wasn't appropriate for you or something.
Yeah. I know. I'm trying to think about.
Well, let me ask you another question. Are there any areas that haven't been examined?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I do think, I guess one of the things I am interested in still is, and that this has been examined, but it's still, to my mind, a little kind of opaque is, let me put it differently. This has been examined a lot, but I think is still kind of interesting. So one of the real questions I have about the bubble is, what exactly the relationships were like between the investment banks and the investors who bought the securities. Because, you know, there seems something odd about the narrative that, you know, these were kind of unsuspecting investors in the sense that you know, they were insurance companies or pension funds or foreign banks, which seem like, in theory, they seem like they should be reasonably sophisticated in terms of their approach to these kinds of things. And yet, there is a kind of narrative, you know, that you heard on the street at the time and that in retrospect you hear quite a bit, that they were kind of rubes, essentially, who were taken in. And that aspect of the story is one that I don't really have a good handle on, but I think is kind of, seems kind of interesting and useful to sort of pursue. The other thing...
do you have any ideas just quickly about what might sort of reconcile that getting money issue?
My take on it, just from the people I've talked to, and I've talked to people, you know, I guess on both sides, is, you know, I actually think that it wasn't necessarily a kind of rube situation. I mean, I think that it was a kind of, you know, bubble mentality that sort of took hold of people and they were really kind of uninterested in it. I also think, and I've written about this quite a bit, that, one of my sort of hobby horses on this for a long time has been the role of the rating agencies, which I know you guys have done a tremendous amount on. And you know, I think that the role the rating agencies played in all this is... pretty fundamental, and the fact that that essentially they have a kind of legal status bestowed by the government, even as non-governmental organizations, basically conferred a tremendous amount of legitimacy on them. And I think that, you know, there was this kind of sense on the part of investors. You know, the way I think a lot about what happened in the crisis more generally, and this is, again, something you've heard a million times already, is, you know, that kind of principal-agent conflicts are really fundamental to a lot of the way decisions get made on Wall Street. And that if you're the agent, if you're the person who's making the decision, whether you're the, you know, the pension fund, the guy making the investment decision for the pension fund or for the bank or whatever it is, that you know, the goal is basically to get yield, but also do so in a way that kind of covers your ass, basically. And that, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that's what the rating agencies basically offer people. And I think so. I think for, you know, these people, as long as they could get a AAA, and you know, it was offered by had the imprimatur of some reasonably respected investment bank, they actually looking in detail at the nature of the transaction was just something that they didn't really have any, at least from my impression, just from talking to them, they didn't have any real interest in doing. That I think that it really was a case where people just kind of abdicated responsibility.
I know that you wrote even just recently about the issues with paperwork in say, the foreclosure market. And it seems like that might have been another issue here, where simply the volume was so high. I mean, should it have just been the case that there were less of these deals being done, or more people employed doing them, or was it really just a staffing problem?
Well, I mean, I think it obviously went well beyond a staffing problem. I think in the sense it went well beyond a staffing problem in terms of, say, on the originator side. You know, I think it's very clear that there was a tremendous amount of fraud. Well, I'll say, I shouldn't say that. I don't know. It seems like there was quite a bit of fraud or sort of sketchy things. I do think that many fewer deals should have been done. And I certainly think that many more people should have been employed to actually manage the paperwork. I mean, you know, the reason in that column I talked about the parallels to the late 60s, which I guess had kind of not really been mentioned much, is that I actually think the parallels are pretty strong. I mean, because, you know, the thing that's striking about what happened on Wall Street in the late 1960s is that, you know, it really was this situation where there was this kind of, you know, indifference to the back end in pursuit because of the pursuit of the front end. So that these firms, instead of hiring people who could actually handle the paperwork and do the transactions, actually just concentrated on getting their salespeople to just generate more and more business. And, you know, the result was, like, as I said, you know, fraud and all these trades that basically were invalidated and the like. And in the case of the housing market, the consequences obviously seem much greater. I mean, both now in terms of the way the foreclosure process is working, but also in terms of the way the paperwork going into these trusts and the like went. I mean, I have to say, I mean, this is like seems like a bizarre thing for a business writer to say, but when you actually look at just one of those trusts and look at the volume, the number of mortgages that go into it, and then the paperwork that in principle, well, I shouldn't even say in principle, I mean, according to the pooling and service agreement, you know, was required in order to make that trust work in terms of signing over each mortgage and the like. The thought that there are, I don't know however many of these there are, is kind of staggering. Now, you can go too far in that direction. I mean, I don't know, Walmart does, I mean, I don't know, how many transactions does Walmart do a day? And they're able to do it. They don't seem to have any trouble, like, you know, basically keeping all their paperwork in order. But I just think that the whole system was set up in such a way that people kind of, the financial incentive to actually do the paperwork right in a bubble just, I guess, seems unimportant, I have no idea. You hear a lot of talk about the fact that in a lot of these trusts, I mean, this is something you're probably looking at, actually, of all the stuff, you know, you mentioned the question earlier about, like, things I've heard. I mean, that's the one question that's interesting that I don't think we have a clear answer to, was is it true that in the case of a lot of these trusts, the mortgages were never literally signed over to the trustee? Like, that's what you hear, which in principle, I guess, would invalidate the trust. I have no idea if that's true, but you certainly hear it. You know, you hear it a lot, that basically the mortgages were just left in a warehouse or, you know, whatever. And it's kind of staggering to think about, but it seems like it might, you know, it like it may have been possible.
Well, Mr. Zerbe, thank you very much for your time this morning. I know that we all here at the Commission greatly appreciate it. I know we'd just like to ask at the very end if it's possible, you know, if there are questions that come up following this, if we can follow up by email.
Yeah, absolutely. You got my email, so just sure. Just drop me a line, and I'd be glad to, you know, I don't know how useful it'll be, but I'm glad to give you whatever you need.
Sure. Well, Mr. Zerbe, thank you very much this morning. Like I said, we're running here on a short timeline with the report due in just about a month, and so we look forward to putting out something that's helpful and maybe answering some of the questions that we went through today.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something I'm really I'll just say, you know, I'm really looking forward to the report, because I think the hearings have so far been pretty amazing, and so I'm really looking forward to what you all come up with.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been very useful.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.